Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. It's nice to see such a big audience, large audience. Welcome to Ledbury Poetry Festival and to Anne's talk on Eleanor Fargen, Something I Remember. This is the 20th year of Ledbury Poetry Festival, and we are very grateful to Arts Council England for their continued funding. We're also very pleased that this event has been sponsored by Friends of the Dymock Poets.
Yes, I'd like to say thank you to the Dymock Poets.
Anne Harvey has loved poetry and theatre from an early age. After school, she went to the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, an important time in her life, acting in and directing plays and studying poetry with a tutor whom she later discovered was in the Artists' Rifles with Edward Thomas, though he never told her this. Age 21, she formed her own company, the Guildhall Players, which ran for 3 summers in Perranporth in Cornwall. And you might be interested to know that the company included one Eileen Atkins, who was at the Poetry Festival yesterday. After the birth of her 2 children, Anne taught drama, adjudicated drama festivals, and was an examiner for speech and drama boards. Her interest in poetry led to her editing poetry anthologies for all ages, winning the Signal Award in 1992 for Shades of Green. She has edited around 40 drama and poetry anthologies and frequently gives talks and readings and has written and presented many programmes for radio. As Eleanor Fargen's literary executor, she's kept very busy, and after 50 years after Eleanor's death, Eleanor Fargen is still, as we know, very popular. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Anne Harvey.
Thank you. Yes, it's incredible how busy she does keep me. And it's not just because of Morning Has Broken, which, of course, many people only know Eleanor Fargen's name because of Morning Has Broken. And frequently, when I've gone to a primary school, the whole school stands up when I go in and sings Morning Has Broken. I was so glad you didn't do that tonight. And they also think I am Eleanor Fargen. And I have to explain that she died in 1965, so quite a long time ago. But she was an extraordinary woman. And although Morning Has Broken is a wonderful hymn, and we've all enjoyed singing it at different times, and it is still popular, I just want to go beyond that and tell you something more about her incredibly interesting life. I'm going to start with a poem which has become one of her favourite poems with schools and adults, and it's now got itself, and she would have been very surprised, onto the school curriculum. I think for years 3 and 4, something like that. And it's called It Was Long Ago. I'll tell you, shall I, something I remember, something that still means a great deal to me. It was long ago. A dusty road in summer, I remember. A mountain and an old house and a tree that stood, you know, behind the house. An old woman, I remember, in a red shawl with a grey cat on her knee, humming under the tree. She seemed the oldest thing I can remember. But then perhaps I was not more than 3. It was long ago. I dragged on the dusty road, and I remember how the old woman leaned over the fence at me and seemed to know how it felt to be 3 and called out, I remember, "Do you like bilberries and cream for tea?" I went under the tree, and while she hummed and the cat purred, I remember how she filled a saucer with berries and cream for me so long ago. Such berries and such cream as I remember, I never had seen before, and never see today, you know. And that is almost all I can remember. The house, the old woman, the grey cat on her knee, her red shawl and the tree, and the taste of the berries, the feel of the sun, I remember. and how that long dusty road seemed to hold for me no end, you know. That is the farthest thing I can remember. It won't mean much to you. It does to me. Then I grew up, you see. In fact, she never did quite grow up, like all of us, like all the best adults. She always kept that sense of childhood, and she got on very well with children. They always loved her, her nieces and nephews, and the children of her friends. She always used to join in their games and tell them stories. When I edited this book, Like Sorrow or a Tune, Piers Plowright, who was a radio director, he knew her when he was a little boy. He lived in a house where he could climb the wall and go up to her cottage in Perrins Court in Hampstead, and she would read him stories. And he said it was just a fairy tale world, that she loved seeing him and he loved seeing her. And years later, she went to his wedding and gave him a lovely present, and I've forgotten what the present was. But it was nice to hear from him of what he thought of her. And her nieces and nephews have always told me what a wonderful aunt she was. Well, her parentage was very important, so I'm going to spend a moment on that. Her father was called Benjamin Leopold Fargen. He actually put the Leopold in himself, because he thought it sounded more important. And he loved books and reading from a very early age. He was a son of a family of Sephardic Jews, out probably in the Moroccan area, who came over to London's East End at the end of the 18th, early 19th century. And they lived in the East End, and he had to leave school. And he was a very clever little boy when he was 12 years old, and he was apprenticed at a local printer's. And if he got up early enough, on the way to the printer's, he used to pass an antiquarian bookshop and used to stop and look in the window and see what book was there. And the bookseller had noticed him. And if he saw the boy reading a story, he would open the next page the next day and the next one the next day. And he came out one day and said, "I've been watching you. I can see you're fond of reading, my boy." And Ben said, "I am, and we don't have many books at home." And the bookseller said, "My shop can be your library. Come and read here whenever you wish." And I just love that story, because I think it was the beginning for him as a writer he became, and also for Eleanor and her brothers as his children. Well, he had a very interesting life, which I won't go into now because it would take about a week to tell you. But he got a little money left to him by an uncle and went on a ship out to Australia and New Zealand to try to find gold. It was the time when that was happening. And on the ship, the editor of the newsletter that they published fell ill. And Ben was able to take the job on. So he got a bit of money for that. And then he worked at various jobs outside and inside, writing stories all the time. He wrote to Dickens, and he got a letter back saying something like, "Thank you for your story. I am glad that you enjoy writing and hope you will keep on doing so." And Ben used to talk about this as this wonderful letter from Dickens, encouraging him to become a very important writer. And the family didn't realize just what a small amount Dickens had actually said, and it was always known as the Dickens letter. But in fact, Ben did go on to write something like 90 books, I think. And I once heard somebody talk about him as one of our great forgotten Victorian novelists. So remember his name in case you can ever find him, Benjamin Leopold Fargen. Well, on his travels, he met Maggie Jefferson. And she was the daughter of a very great actor, Joseph Jefferson, who in America, the Jefferson family, were as famous as the Terrys and the Irvings in our country. And he fell in love with Maggie. And they became married. They had their first child in America. That was Harry. And then they came back with Harry to England. And they lived in London, in Buckingham Street, just off the Strand, in apartments at the top of a big house there, a house where Samuel Pepys had once stayed. I don't think Eleanor knew that when she was a child, because the plaque to Pepys went up much later. But they couldn't stay there forever. Ben was writing, he was beginning to make money, but then after Eleanor, they had another child, Charlie, who very sadly died when he was only 18 months old. And then they had another one called Joseph and decided that they would have to move to a bigger house. And they went out to Hampstead, which in those days was rather like a village. And they found a house there down in Swiss Cottage area of Hampstead. And this is where Eleanor's childhood was spent. Now, she wrote a wonderful autobiography of her childhood called A Nursery in the 90s, which tells how her father, because he had so little education himself, didn't believe in too much education for children. And whereas the boys went to school for a while, they went to a little prep school, and later on, the youngest boy actually went to University College School, which is a very good boys' school. Eleanor only ever had a governess, and the boys shared the governess for a while, and she was told by Ben, I don't want my children to learn anything that doesn't interest them. The girl gets headaches, leave her alone. Well, the governess didn't leave her alone, but it was a magical sort of childhood where they made a great deal of their own entertainment. By this time, Ben had a library of 8,000 books, and the children were given access to this library. They weren't told, oh, that's not suitable. They could read anything that they liked, and if they didn't like it, they put it back. And every Sunday after lunch, he gave them one special book to keep for themselves. They all wrote from a very early age, from all to use a typewriter, from around the age of 6 or 7, and they started a family magazine. The two younger boys were the ones, Bertie and Joe, who concentrated on this, and it started off as Fargent's Weekly. I've got a drawer full of copies of it. But they couldn't keep that going too long. Weekly was rather hard work, so it became Fargent's Fortnightly, and Eleanor often contributed to this. She was writing from a very early age, and I've actually put in this book, if I can find them, I tried to mark everything as carefully as I could. I made a lot of notes yesterday and left them at home. But this was a poem she wrote to, I don't know if you've come across the name Albury, A-L-B-E-R-Y. They were a very well-known theatre family, Sir Bronson Albury. No? Well, there was a theatre called the Albury Theatre. I don't think it's called that anymore. But they were friends with the Fargents, who knew a lot of people, actors, writers, musicians, artists, and they were all in and out of the house. So that was part of the education that the Fargent children have. But to one of the Albury family, a boy called, a nickname, Button, Eleanor wrote to him this poem. My heart has never beat before as it did beat just now. I want you but to keep to me, and I'll give my hand to thou. I'll never turn away from thee if always you keep true. But if you always turn away, I will not keep to you. You've turned away from me just once, but if you won't again, I'll give you all the love my heart will ever and can contain. And her father tried to stop her doing all these and thous, and tried to get her to modernize her writing, which, of course, eventually she did. Later on, she wrote with such diversity about so many different subjects that I thought I would read you this poem that she wrote when she was 9, which was really almost like becoming an advertising copywriter at that age. And it's called The Five Advertisements of Happiness. I write you down a very long list, through and through, of things you ought to have and things you ought to do. You'll always be happy and always have hope as long as you wash with Pears Patent Soap. Of course, you like the things that are very nice to eat, and there is one thing that in your house ought to have a seat. Some people say it isn't good, but then they're very fellish. I don't know what that word is, really. For you couldn't get along without Goodall's Yorkshire relish. So I think she was quite clever. Oh, this is the last verse. But oh, there's something else I ought to have said before. And of this, more than the others, you ought to have a store. It'll cure you of your pains and cure you of your ills. So always keep a box of Beecham's patent pills. And I think you can see that for a 9-year-old, she was already in the right kind of way of knowing what would be popular. And she also wrote rather dramatic poetry, and her father got very excited when she wrote 60 lines of a kind of Greek epic, which he could take along to his club. I don't think I'll read you the whole of it, but it ends with, "Then will come the cry, chaos is dead, and all will be destroyed that he has done. But now and until then, we'll live in peace and love and happiness." And when she wrote a story that she wanted him to see, and she used to lie down on her bed, and he would come in when she'd asked him to come and read something. And he walked round and round her bed one day, and she thought he was going to say it wasn't good enough. And then she said, "Do you like it, Papa? It's the best thing you've ever written, Nelly." She was always Nelly. "I think you're going to become a writer one day." And she cherished that line always in her head. So the childhood was, Harry was the oldest brother, the one who was born in America, a brilliant musician from an early age, and so he was always playing the piano, and they invented songs that they sang to his music. And he was also in charge. Their mother, Maggie, the American mother, she said, "I never had any trouble bringing you children up. I left all that to Harry." So Harry took this very seriously, and he made rules that they had to abide by. And there were rules about washing your hands if you ever went near his piano, not taking somebody else's book or toys away from them, and certain things like your bedtime. And he was given a special pocket watch, and he would put it on the table. And at 8:30, right up until they were about 12 years old, the two little boys had to go to bed. And Nelly went to bed at 9:00 until she was 16. And he used to say, "Bedtime, Nelly." And she would go, and then she said, "Mama, I don't want to go to bed at 9:00. And she said, "Well, you'll just have to sit it out and just don't let Harry get his way." And she did, and he didn't speak to her for a few days afterwards. He was so cross. He was an extraordinary character, a real eccentric. People have often said, people who knew him, and I met some of his students when they were much older, because he became a music professor, that he had something of the writer Lewis Carroll about him. He was quite eccentric, but very clever. Anyway, he invented wonderful games that they played in the nursery. And with Eleanor, he invented a game which was called TAR, T-A-R. That stood for the names Tessie and Ralph. And those were the names of the babes in the wood in a pantomime that they'd been taken to. Probably they knew the actors in the pantomime, the director. This happened often. But when they came back from this particular one, they said, "Let's be Tessie and Ralph." Tessie was the girl babe, and Ralph was the good woodcutter, I think, something like that. And they played this game, and the other two children weren't allowed to join in. And then the game extended itself so that they would be playing famous Greek myths, Shakespeare characters, and it wouldn't matter who was the male and who was the female, as it doesn't in the theatre today, as we now have a female Henry V, as you know. So it might well be that she would be Henry V and Harry would be Princess Catherine. I don't know. But they used to play this game until it got almost out of control, and then suddenly Harry would say, "Now we're Harry and Nelly again." And whatever she felt like, they just had to stop. And he sounds like a bit of a dictator. In a way, he was. But he was also a very inspiring character. And he did have a great influence on her life. And I think people who look into psychology probably read more into it than actually they needed to, because they remained close friends all their lives, really. After a while, the two younger boys were sometimes allowed to join in, and the four of them used to just rampage around the house playing these games. And there were always books, there was always writing, and Fargin's Fortnightly had to be written, and Eleanor contributed to that. And then the two boys were mad on cricket. And Eleanor got very interested in cricket as well. And somewhere I've marked a poem that she wrote later on. It was called "The Dull Side of Things." I did not care in the days gone by whether a match was one day or three. Under drizzling rain or a dreary sky, cricket was never too dull for me. I was willing to wait an hour in queue, and when I got in, the Hoad CB decide that they wouldn't begin till two. Cricket was never too dull for me. I was willing to sit for half a day with a bag of buns and a flask of tea, and not a prospect of morning play. Cricket was never too dull for me. I was willing to feel the hard, hard seat grow harder than wood is supposed to be, while pins and needles assailed my feet. But cricket was never too dull for me. And when after hours the play began, and Barnes took 7 for 43, and I yelled with the crowd as a single man, cricket was never too dull for me. And she wrote another one called "The Game That's Done, The Game That's Never Done." So she tried to interest her things in what the boys liked, and she was a great contributor to their magazine and to Fargin's Fortnightly too. The two little boys used to go to Lord's, because living in Hampstead they weren't that far away, and these two boys had lorgnettes, and they had long curly hair like little ringlets and sailor suits. And I think it must have been very comical to see these two boys going off to Lord's, and they knew their cricket names absolutely all their lives. They used to talk about them. But it was quite sad for her as the boys grew up and went off on their own ideas of what they were interested in and what they became. Harry became, at the Royal Academy of Music, he became a student. He was the youngest student there. He later became the youngest professor. He did involve Eleanor. She wrote the libretto for a couple of compositions, which big went to, and they were well reviewed. And the two younger boys went off to Joe, the third one. He became an actor for a while. He actually acted with Henry Irving and Ellen Terry, only playing walk-on parts. And Bertie became a journalist and a writer. He was a very, very clever boy. And he hated the newspaper world. As a reporter, he hated being told if there'd been a murder or a nasty case, go out and get their grief. He hated that. And so he finally left and started writing himself. And he was the one that had a circle of writing friends and introduced Eleanor to his group of people. They were really a kind of sidelong to the Bloomsbury group. they actually knew some of the same people. And in this group of friends that Bertie had made were people like the doctor, Godwin Baynes, Myra Hess, Arnold Bax, the great composer, and his brother Clifford, who was a writer, notable people who were going to become very well known. And this was when Eleanor, as a young woman, first met the poet Edward Thomas. And she met him with her brother Bertie in what was then the cottage tea rooms in the Strand. And the first time she met Edward, she was rather bowled over by the handsomeness of this man and his beautiful voice. Many people commented on Edward Thomas's voice and how lovely it was to listen to him. And she said, "When we parted, I hoped that we should meet again." Well, I don't know if you know the story of the four-year friendship that she had with Edward Thomas. She thought herself a very plain woman, and people have often said she was very plain. But in fact, some of the... This is a photograph of her, which I think she's really quite presentable. I've seen people who look far more attractive than that. But she always felt she wasn't a success out in the sort of market of young girls and men. And she was shy, and she was writing, and she was longing to become a well-known writer. I think the family funded her first book, which was... I think it still happens, actually. People give a publisher some money, and they publish a book. I have seen that happen. What do they call it? Vanity publishing, is it? Is that what it's called? Something like that. But that was her first book. But it was a little while before she became well known. But she became very close to Edward Thomas and his family. And it was never a love affair, as we might think of it. But it was a very, very loving friendship. And she certainly contributed a great deal to his writing life. And there was later on a radio program in which it was suggested, this was when she was much older, that there had been an affair between these two. And it was called a ménage à trois with his wife, Helen. And Eleanor was very upset about this and got in touch with the director of the program. And they had it cut out of the repeat. I don't know if they ever have things cut out of repeats now. I expect they do. But it wasn't true. They did not have an affair, but she did become a very important part of his life, and he became much more than an important part of hers. She actually said at one time, later in her life, "I loved once more than I would ever love again." I'll come back to what actually happened with her love life later. But with Edward, she was very good with his family. The children adored her. I knew Madame Wee Thomas very well, the younger daughter, who was alive until, I can't remember what year she died. She was very aged then. But she would talk to me a great deal about Eleanor and how much, as a small child, how important Eleanor was in her life, telling her stories and poetry. And they kept in touch with each other always. But Edward, it's very interesting. When I was giving another talk about Edward, I realized that several of the important lines that have been quoted that Edward Thomas spoke in his life had been actually said to Eleanor. One of them... And you know, they come out in different biographies. They're probably quoted in every biography, in every talk that's given. One of them was, "Every man thinks that Hamlet was written for him, but I know he was written for me." That was one. And then there was another one about, "Don't give any thought to this flat grey shore," and that was often quoted. And then there was another time when she was staying with the Thomas family in Hampshire, and she had read a book of Edward's essays in bed the night before. And when she came down to breakfast the next morning, she said to Edward, "Haven't you ever written poetry, Edward?" And he answered, "Me? I couldn't write a poem to save my life." And of course became one of the most popular poets after he met Robert Frost. And Robert Frost convinced him, probably more than Eleanor had, that he had been a poet all the time. But once he started writing poetry, he would always send the poems to Eleanor, ask for her opinion. It was a very loving friendship, and 200 letters passed between them. When you think of us today, how many of us have written 200 letters? And they were all collected by Eleanor in a book with, in between the letters she wrote about their life and all the kinds of things that were going on with their friends and families, called The Last 4 Years. And that book is not, I'm not sure if it's in print at the moment. It went into a kind of e-book, a Faber e-book, but it ought to come back into print because it reveals a great deal of Edward Thomas's character and Eleanor's as well. When Edward joined the army, that's another a line that's always quoted, when he came to her. He used to go to her mother's house. Her father had died, which was, she missed her father very much. Her mother became quite elderly and not very well, still living in Hampstead. And Edward often used to use their house as his London address to write to publishers. And he was there with her one day when he told her that he had decided to join the Artist Rifles and go to war. And she said to him later on, when he was about to join up, "Do you know, Edward, what you were fighting for?" And he bent and picked up a piece of earth and let it run through his fingers. And he said, literally, "For this." And that is quoted again and again and again. I don't think she would ever know just how often her words, or words that had been said to her as well, were actually quoted. Because in many ways, I suppose intellectual people tend to look on her as rather a cozy, homely writer of children's stories who perhaps wasn't quite as important. But in fact, I think she was very much more important than has been thought. When Edward was out in France in the army, that was when she started writing Nursery Rhymes of London Town. That's a cover of one of the early editions. It was in 1916 that it was published. And you know how much this country loves centenaries. It is the centenary of this book. And the artist who illustrated the book was MacDonald Gill. Do you know Eric Gill? MacDonald was one of his brothers, known as Max Gill. And Max Gill is lesser known, but you may have come across his brilliant maps that he used to design. Absolutely fantastic. And he was very involved with the lettering and the calligraphy for railway posters and railway signs. And he also did the stone lettering on the graves of First World War soldiers. And I don't think that's always been known. Very luckily for me, with the centenary, the great niece of MacDonald Gill lives just a few minutes away from me. And together we are doing a lot of programs about these Nursery Rhymes of London Town. These very much show how Eleanor could turn her hand to all kinds of odd writing, really. She loved puns, and she loved word meanings and turning words around. So that, for instance, when she did, these are some cards that we've been having made, because we've got lots of bookings in libraries. This is Hammersmith. So they're all different parts of London. So instead of writing about the place Hammersmith, we have a smith, and he's got a hammer, and he's shoeing his pony. So, "Hammer Smith, Hammer Smith, what will you shoe my pony with? I'll shoe it with a shoe of steel, another of gold so red, a third shoe of ivory, and a fourth shoe of lead. Then I'll pay you with a brass farthing I picked up out of the railway. So hammer, smith, for I want to ride down the Broadway. Unfortunately, Max Gill didn't illustrate them all, which was such a nuisance because my favourite one is Kensal Rise. And it's all about a girl called Kensal who won't get up in the morning. And it ends with, get up, Kensal, Kensal, rise. So we're going to see if children might make their own illustration for it. This is one of the most popular ones. King's Cross, what shall we do? His purple robe is rent in two. Out of his crown he's torn the gems. He's thrown his scepter into the Thames. The court is shaking in its shoe. King's Cross, what shall we do? Leave him alone for a minute or two. Now, Bertie, the youngest brother, Eleanor's youngest brother, whenever he got into a kind of stropple, was naughty and threw himself down, they used to say, leave him alone for a minute or two. So that had a kind of family interest. Some of them were coloured. Unfortunately, they weren't all. That's Threadneedle Street. And Edward wrote her a letter saying he loved them. He adored getting these, which he used to send in the post. He said that his favourite one was St. Mary Axe. And it's a very odd little poem. St. Mary Axe was a church in the city, which is no longer there. And it's where the, what do you call it? What's that thing that's there now? The gherkin. It's round about where the gherkin is. And it's St. Mary Axe, St. Mary Axe. And it has in it, St. Mary Axe, whatever you lax. And I couldn't understand this. And I looked up the word axe in a big dictionary. And it's really what some of the African and Asian people, Caribbean people, they say axe. And it's St. Mary Ask, whatever you lax. But she, you know, I didn't know that it was used then. But I found out it was. It was a kind of colloquial use. I'd never heard anyone say, oh, well, he axed me. Have you? You have. So, what, English people? Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting. Anyway, Edward loved that. And he loved the last line particularly. And he said, I don't know why I like this so much, but I do. And there were other people who wrote to her about that as well. And at the same time, she was writing for the Daily Herald. Have I got it here? Have I lost it? She was writing for the Daily Herald under the name of Tom Fool. I can't find it. Maybe I did bring it. I'll try and find it afterwards so you can see it. She called herself Tom Fool. That was her pseudonym. And she used to write, how extraordinary, I can't think where it's gone. Oh, here we are. I'm so sorry. Tomfooleries by Tom Fool. She also wrote for a magazine for women, and she wrote under the name of Chimera for that. But this one, how she would write was, if there was something in the paper, some event that happened that was written up in the paper. I mean, she would be having a wonderful time at the moment with the government, I think. She would turn it into a poem, and the next day, I'm just trying to think which is a good one to read you. There's a favourite one of mine is about a sleeping judge. Apparently, it was in a paper. I should have marked this, but I haven't. If anyone likes to ask me a question while I'm looking, I'm quite happy. I may be able to find it, and I may not. That cricket one that I read you earlier actually turned up in this as well. And quite often she would use a poem and then use it again later. I can't find the one I want. Oh, no, here it is. Good. In the paper, in the Daily Herald, there was this, something about a judge who had fallen asleep while he was meant to be judging the case. And the little quote at the beginning of the poem, which is called Ravenous Justice. There is nothing worse than a starving judge. Judge Kluwer on a journey for luncheon. So he left the case in the middle so he could get his lunch. And Eleanor wrote the next morning, nothing is worse than a starving judge, for only suppose the judge unfed. He might, poor fellow, in error smudge the laws of the land and lose his head. He might be tempted to steal a ham or sausages made of cow or pig, conceal in his gown a pot of jam, or hide a kipper under his wig. And what, oh what, would the court believe if he sentenced Bill Jones for pinching a purse and a bun dropped out of his lordship's sleeve? Frankly, I ask you, what could be worse? Then lest Dame Justice should suffer abuse, a meal to the woolsack let no man grudge. For a starving tramp, there is some excuse, but nothing is worse than a starving judge. And there were many like that, and they were really quite witty, and nobody knew who Tom Fool was. Well, at the same time, she was beginning to write children's books, children's stories, and they became very popular. And whereas her first poetry hadn't sold very well, she began to be one of the foremost children's writers. And many of her books still are in print, and some of them are e-books, which I don't like very much, but I know that people do. And then she and Bertie started writing together, and they wrote Kings and Queens. They loved their history from childhood, and that's a cover from the original copy. Kings and Queens by Eleanor and Herbert Fargen, and it was illustrated by Rosalind Thornycroft. She was one of their group that I told you about earlier, who used to be rather like the Bloomsbury group. They used to go to the theatre together. They used to play games, tennis. I don't think Eleanor ever played games. She wasn't a games person. But Rosalind Thornycroft was one of the daughters of Sir Hamo Thornycroft, who was a wonderful sculptor. You can see his sculptures all over London still. And Rosalind married Herbert Fargen, so was Eleanor's sister-in-law, and she illustrated this book. And it's never been out of print. What's his name? What's the name of that historian? It'll come back to me in a minute. Antonia Fraser said that these were the poems that turned her into a historian. Does anyone have a favourite king or queen? Don't say Henry VIII. Whenever you go into a school and ask, hey, who is say Henry VIII? One of my favourites is Edward II. Although these are written perhaps with children in mind, they're not at all childish. And I think that's true of a great deal of Eleanor's writing. She never sort of minces words or changes vocabulary to make it childlike. And the wit of some of these is very adult indeed, particularly Edward II. This is a later copy with a different illustrator. These illustrations were what they call penny plain, tuppence coloured, like the old toy theatre characters, and they are rather lovely. And in fact, that has been republished by the British Library, and you can get copies of it still. But this is the one that Penguin has just published, which is not as nice, but it has got the poems in it. Edward II, 1307. Edward II is commonly reckoned one of the feeblest of all of our kings. Favours he lavished on pretty Piers Gaveston, giving him duchies and riches and rings. This sugar-candified, puffed-up and dandified man defied all of the barons with sneers, playing jewellery, dressed up in jewellery, sent by King Ned to his sugar plum Piers. Though Ned was mad about this giddy gadabout, others had about all they could bear. So the king's favourite they made to pay for it, on a fine day for it, spring in the air. When those who hated Piers decapitated Piers, Edward was sorry, but everyone said, "We executed him, seeing it suited him. Long ere we cut it off, Piers lost his head." And they are very, very clever. Bertie went on to become a writer of West End reviews. It was Bertie who later on discovered Joyce Grenfell and wrote for her. And he was extremely clever. He was also a wonderful Shakespearean scholar and did all the BBC Shakespeare programs and also did an annotated Shakespeare for the Nonsuch Press. So give me another king or queen you'd like to hear. Charles the First. Where did he come? I'm not very good at this. Charles the First. Charles. Oh, 1625. Charles the First. King Charles, he was a gentleman who wore the finest suits, with scented gloves upon his hands and lace upon his boots. His hat, it had the widest brim and very longest feather, and in a golden barge he sailed the Thames in summer weather. King Charles was such a gentleman, he couldn't rule the land, for all the lace upon his boot and perfume on his hand. Alas, alas, his wide-brimmed hat, alas, his sweeping feather. King Charles, he lost both hat and head one winter day together. One more? What? Oh, no, we haven't, have we? Well, our queen is added on at the end. Now, where is Elizabeth? Where did she come? She was after Henry VIII, wasn't she? Yeah. Yes. Hail, Queen Elizabeth. Here comes Queen Bess in a very big ruff and a very wide dress. Her hair it is red, and her eyes they are green, and England has prospered since Bess became queen. The boldest of sailors have sailed to the west, the greatest of poets have written their best, the gayest of people have danced on the green, and England's grown merry since Bess became queen. She's vain as a peacock that opens its tail, she's proud as an eagle that weathers the gale, she's crafty and jealous, suspicious and mean, but England is England. Now Bess is the queen. And after Bertie died, because sadly he died rather young, in 1945, it was the day of the Japanese victory of the war, our victory over Japan, VJ Day. Elizabeth II was added by Eleanor. So the queens come and so the queens go, and what they were like we shall never quite know, till history's mystery comes to a close, and here is the queen that everyone knows. And the queen mother sent a very nice letter, which came to me actually, although I'd never met her, about Eleanor's centenary, when we had the celebration for it in Berghaus Museum in Hampstead, near to where Eleanor lived. And also Camilla has written me a very nice letter. I haven't brought it with me. When this came out again 3 years ago, I sent a copy to them because I thought they should have it. And she wrote a charming letter back, and she loves the poems. She said she grew up with them. They are really quite legendary. Actually, the one in here, the one of William and Mary, always amuses me because These illustrations were done by Robin Jakes, who is a wonderful illustrator. You possibly have seen him in many, many children's books. But his sister was Hattie Jakes. And I think he's made this look like Hattie Jakes. It's very like her, actually. I don't know if she ever saw that picture. But yeah. So Bertie became, as I've told you, a very well-known theatre director and writer, and Eleanor often wrote for him. And Joe was the big surprise, because Joe was prolific. Like the father, who wrote nearly 100 books, Joe was a very, very good journalist. He wrote for several papers, and he was the most unusual of the Fargians, I think. Eleanor was very, very fond of him. She adored him, really. And she said, nobody has really quite got to know about how clever Joe is. And some of his short stories were turned into films by Hitchcock. There's one called Exit, which is very good, and Number 17, which was a West End play that Joe wrote, became a film that Hitchcock made. And just last year, he's sort of come out of the woodwork. I mean, he's been dead many, many years. With his detective stories, he must have written about 90 detective stories in the great age of detective story writing. And you can find little quips about him by Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers saying, Joseph Jefferson Fargian is the best of all of us. He was the only one of the family given the name of Jefferson, of the famous actor. So he was sometimes known as Jeff or just Jefferson Fargian. And he's come out, they've republished a lot of detective stories of the 30s and 40s. Maybe you've found them in the bookshops. The British Library have republished them. And Joe is the number one bestseller. I just wish he was alive and we could let him know. Maybe he does know. I don't know. But extraordinary family. You know how very gifted they were. But to go back to Eleanor, her stories and her poems, as well as her journalism, just sort of poured out of her, really. She wrote during both wars under different pseudonyms, so it's sometimes hard to find out exactly which poems were written by her, because she used these different names. But she was always very concerned with people being badly treated. During the Spanish War, she wrote some quite moving poems about that. But her stories, am I okay for time? How are we? No, I should stop, shouldn't I? This book, The Little Book Room, was in a way, I suppose it's what people remember very well, because it's, well, Ardizzone became one of her very important illustrators. And she wrote a marvelous, do you know illustrations, Edward Ardizzone? A lovely poem for him, which is actually in the book, but I don't think we're going to have time for that. This is the book towards the end of her life when her stories were all collected. She wrote about 80 books were published altogether, I think. And she won the Carnegie Medal, the Regina Medal, which is an American one, and the Hans Andersen Medal. She was offered a dameship, but she said, no, thank you. I don't want to be thought different from the milkman. So there we are. She lived in this little cottage in Perrin's Walk in Hampstead, and people used to go to see her there. Robert Frost, when he came over to England, spent a very long time with her. He could hardly tear himself away. And I've now missed out all the stuff about that I wanted to tell you about when she came up here in the summer of 1914. Edward Thomas's family invited her to find digs up here and be part of their summer holiday. And she wrote very movingly about that. And I didn't really mean to leave that out, but I have done now. But I ought to end, I think, with one of the poems. She wrote a lot of sonnets to Edward Thomas. And the one that has been rather popular I think I know it, but I don't want to go wrong. In the last letter that I had from France, you thanked me for the silver Easter egg, which I had hidden in the box of apples you liked to munch beyond all other fruit. You found the egg the Monday before Easter and said, "I will praise Easter Monday now. It was such a lovely morning." Then you spoke of the coming battle and said, "This is the eve. Goodbye, and may I have a letter soon." That Easter Monday was a day for praise. It was such a lovely morning. In our garden, we sowed our earliest seeds, and in the orchard, the apple bud was ripe. It was the eve. There are three letters that you will not get. And that was the last. And those three letters have never been found. They must have arrived in France after he died. But the mystery of why he opened the Easter egg and the Cox's orange pippins, which came from Fortnum and Mason, only the best for Edward, has never, you know, why he got the day wrong, I don't know. But anyway, she went on, she lived with a schoolmaster called George Earle, English schoolmaster, who met Edward Thomas once, and she was always so pleased about that. She never married him. She said what I told you earlier, that she'd already loved once more than she would ever love again. And she said, we sealed as true a marriage as necessary. And she lived, and you know, this was in, you know, 1920. She lived with him for about 25 years till he died. And I'm going to just finish with one more poem. She then, if I haven't lost it, she had a very great friend. She had many friends. I mean, somebody once said to me, "Eleanor was the best friend of everyone she ever met. She was just wonderful." But one of her very close friends played the lead in her story, The Silver Curlew, which was the story of Rumpelstiltskin, which she wrote as a story and a very good play called The Silver Curlew. And this actor, who was also a RADA teacher, Dennis Blakelock, a very well-known actor, became a very dear friend of hers and absolutely adored her. He wrote a book about her called Portrait of a Fajan. But she wrote this for him. No, he wrote this for her. "Do not be sad for a time that seems swiftly ended. Nothing can end days that have been so perfectly befriended by friend and friend. For their perfection was neither of time nor of place, nor of any weather or mood that brightened or shadowed this little space of being together. It has been a cupful of time, dipped out of an endless sea. It has been a handful of earth that might have been fruitless and friendless, and love made green. What was begun in time and place is unfinished. There is no end. And the sea is unemptied, the earth is undiminished for friend and friend." And just finally, this book is called Like Sorrow or a Tune. And I found it scribbled out, this poem, which is a popular poem of Eleanor's. "The night will never stay, the night will still go by, though with a million stars you pin it to the sky. Though you bind it with the blowing wind and buckle it with the moon, the night will slip away like sorrow or a tune."
I've gone on too long.